So we're in lesson 5 of the intertestamental history class that we've been going for about 5 weeks. Now, next week will be the end of our study. And so that's, although I'm excited about reaching the conclusion of our study, I'll also be kind of sad. I guess I should turn this on too. There. Oh. There we go. Okay. I appreciate, again, everybody's attention. There's a few extra lesson copies up here. And again, if you want an additional test on Acts, feel free to take it. It's there for the taking. My material is going to come from F.F. Bruce's New Testament History. It's also going to come from Charles Pfeiffer's Between the Testaments. And again, I am indebted to Kyle Campbell for the use of his material. He has done an excellent job of a very thorough job of putting this information together. So I modified his material and used it. I do want to give credit where credit is due. All right, so in lessons 1, 2, and the very end of lesson 3, what were we dealing with? What were we talking about?
Persian rule.
The Persian rule, that they had overthrown the Babylonians, they had overthrown the Medians, or the Medes, and they had fused with them to form the Medo-Persian Empire. And at one point, they ruled the entire Eastern world, or Middle Eastern world, rather, all the way to Greece, but they never were able to conquer Greece. In lesson 3, we covered who?
Alexander the Great,
who came along and defeated the Persians, even though it looked like he wasn't going to be able to do that. However, he never lost a battle. Historically, he is the only military general in recorded history who has never lost a battle, especially in for how long he was campaigning. And so that was notable. However, he died at the age of 32. He did not live very long. And so the Diadochi, or the successors, took over then. And you're seeing some of them on here now. There were 4 of them. You had Lysimachus of Thrace. You had Cassander of Macedonia. You had Ptolemy of Egypt. And you had Seleucus of his own self-named Seleucid Empire. And these 4 men would then divide the known world amongst themselves with a shadow looming in the background. And who is that shadow looming in the background?
Rome.
That's going to be Rome. And again, you're going to see that they've already, at this point, they've taken the city of Syracuse, which was, for a long time, it had been a bastion of a Greek city on the southeastern corner of Sicily there. Carthage also had a holding there on Sicily, but they had completely taken that by this point. This is in the year 200 BC, so you're only 200 years out from the time of Christ. You can already see Rome growing. They're growing into the Iberian Peninsula. They're growing into Greece. You can see them just on the edge there of Macedonia, that they're beginning to work their way over into the territories we've been dealing with. And so in lesson 4 then, we looked at how the successors' relationships played out and the wars, the raids, the skirmishes that followed. And we dealt largely with the relationship between, and you can see really where our concern would be, is right in here. There is going to be conflict after conflict between the Seleucids and Egypt. Because remember, you have desert down here, you have desert down here, you have ocean right here. So there was only one way into the nation of Egypt, and that is, of course, by the eastward way. But if you hold Palestine, as long as Egypt held Palestine, you could not attack them from the eastern way. So it was a very crucial location, and is going to be hotly contested in their history of ancient warfare. So we then looked at, despite all of that and the Hellenism that was rampant in that area, there were a few individuals who were not going to stand for it. And who were they? Mattathias and his sons, who were known as the Maccabees. They were known as the Maccabees, and their history is, of course, recorded in the books 1st and 2nd Maccabee. Is it inspired?
No.
Does it have to be inspired for it to be accurate or true or good history? No, I'm using books that are not inspired, but you know what? It's still good history. It still accurately records what happened. And so we can look at then books like 1st and 2nd Maccabees, and we can see some of the struggles they went through, some of the things they did go through. In fact, the writer of 1st and 2nd Maccabees even makes a claim saying there were no prophets in Israel during this time. So he even admits from a principle, look, I'm not inspired. And secondly, he says that I did the best I could. If it's great, great. If it's not, I did the best I could. So he even admits that this is his own work of trying to faithfully record what happened. So we are then looking at a time period of when they were able to push and push the Syrians and the Seleucids out of the control of this area. And this would then lead to an autonomous Jewish state led by the Maccabees. However, by the time they all had passed away, and that's where we left it last time, you're then seeing the Hasmonean dynasty come into play. And the Hasmonean dynasty is simply a name from one of their ancestors that they applied to the autonomous Jewish rulers that are going to exist in between Seleucid rule or Syrian rule and Roman rule. The Hasmoneans were the ones who ruled during that time.
And they were actually descendants of the same of the Maccabean.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, they are in the lineage of the Maccabees, which is important to note. They're not in the lineage of David. These are not the lineage of David, which is important because Jeconiah had a prophecy concerning him that no king of his descendants would ever sit on the throne of Judah ever again. Which means, by the way, just as an aside, Jesus can't reign here on the earth then because he is a descendant of Jeconiah. So he'll never sit on the throne of David, just as a prophecy, as a promise from God. The lineage of David would no longer sit on that throne ever again because of Jeconiah. All right, let's move into the Hasmonean dynasty. Hasmonean dynasty. Again, are you going to read about these individuals in your text?
No.
No, you're not going to read about them in your Bible. Why? This is the purpose of this class. It covers a time period where you're not going to see them in your Bible. You're not going to read about these individuals. It ends with Persians and begins with Romans. Somewhere in there, these guys were. So if it is unfamiliar, that's okay, because that's the purpose of the class, is to look at these names, look at this dynasty, which largely is unfamiliar to a lot of people, so that's okay. So let's begin by looking at, and you can hear it in the title, the growth and decay of the Hasmonean dynasty. They did not last very long, because again, you're 200 years out. At this point, they didn't even exist. We're backing up for a moment so you can see where Rome was in relationship to all of these others. So we're not even to the Hasmonean dynasty on this map yet. We got to jump ahead to the year 135 BC. We got to jump ahead a good 70 years before we actually reach the formulation of the Hasmoneans. I want to point out a few things along the way, though, before we get there, that we can see, again, as we progress from 200 to 166, what happened? You'll notice, absolutely, there's a lot more red on there that was not there before. Again, for the sake of the recording, the map that we're using is geacron.com. It's geacron.com, and it's completely free to use. You can see how much red is now on the map. They are growing, and they're growing very rapidly. And it's because one of their military capabilities, they had a very efficient way of managing their armies and their legions. And then secondly, they had a pickup by this point called the Marian Reforms, which turned a largely civilian volunteer army into a professional fighting force, where the government actually started paying for their weapons and their gear and things like that. You could be a professional soldier now, instead of just a civilian soldier. So the gear got a lot better. The organization got a lot better. And what Marius did for Rome in those reforms was turn them into a dangerous fighting force. And this would carry them all the way into about 200 AD before they actually started losing steam. So that's notable to mention as well. By the time we hit 134, and this is the beginning of the Hasmonean dynasty here. They began in 135. You can already see that Carthage has completely been taken over by Rome. They have been completely and utterly destroyed by this point, leaving Rome just about uncontested in the far western world. There was nothing left to stand in their way. They had Gauls to the north, but they were winning victories against the Gauls. And they had, you'll notice, completely taken what other notable area?
Greece.
They had completely taken Greece, Macedonia, Sparta. All of that was under Roman control by this point. And of course, by the end of the lesson, if you've looked ahead in your lesson, we're going to see Rome enter Palestine in this lesson, which they've got a long way to go, and there's a lot of colors in between them and there, but that's going to be to their detriment, because Rome, united against all of them, would be able to take them one by one. You will notice, if you can see it, there is a green smudge right here. You see that green smudge? That's the Hasmonean dynasty. And that is where we're going to spend our time this morning, looking at that little green smudge, because that little green smudge is the area around Judah, the area around Jerusalem. This is the control of the Hasmoneans. Let's look at John Hyrcanus to begin, the first Hasmonean ruler. Although powerful enough to conquer Jerusalem, Syria offered recognition to Hyrcanus on the condition that Hyrcanus considered himself subject to Syria and promised to help in Syrian military campaigns. So basically they're saying, we'll say you're in control, but you have to do what we say. We have no way of enforcing that whatsoever, and you'll probably beat us if we attack you, but let's just say that we're stronger than you and that you're under our control. That's largely what they did at this point. And Hyrcanus knew it. So they were like, okay, sure, we're still autonomous from you. We're still separate from you. And so they left Palestine. The Hellenizing party disappeared from the Jewish political scene. Remember, they lost a lot of steam when the Maccabeans picked up steam. The Hellenizers, or the Greek-influenced Jews, were largely losing power. That's going to change very, very soon, though. The Hasidim did not completely align themselves with the Maccabees. Up to this point, they wanted to stop short of political independence in their dealings with the Syrians. They didn't care if they had an independent state or not. That's not what they were really concerned about. What they didn't want is they didn't want the Hellenizers in. They didn't want to have to be forced to worship false gods. They didn't want to be forced to wear Greek clothing or participate in any Greek acts. They were fine being under the control of someone else as long as they had their religious freedoms. And so they start to drop off in their support as well. So the Hellenizers had to leave because the Maccabees came in. But the Hasidim themselves, or those pious ones, were also hesitant to take it any further. In the subsequent history of the Hellenistic party, the ideals were perpetuated in the party of the Sadducees. We have finally put a name on the Hellenizers, and you're going to find them throughout your Old Testament after this point. They're going to...
New Testament.
Yeah, your New Testament, absolutely. You're going to see them in your New Testament now. And then if you keep on reading in your notes, the ideals of the Hasidim, or those pious ones, were perpetuated in the party of the Pharisees. So the Hellenizers are the... And the Hasidim are the...
Pharisees.
Sadducees are Hellenistic. Hasidim, Pharisees. Those two groups go together. This is incredibly important to note. These parties are first mentioned during the lifetime of Hyrcanus. At the beginning of the Hasmonean dynasty, that is where the Pharisees and the Sadducees are first mentioned as parties, as sects of Judaism. Before his death, he repudiated the Pharisees and declared himself a Sadducee. So at this point, he was a Pharisee. He had followed the ways of the Hasidim. He had followed in the Maccabean line. But at this point, he changes. He repudiates the Pharisees. He becomes a Sadducee. The rule of John Hyrcanus was one of territorial expansion. Although devout Jews frequently differed with his policies, his personal life was free from suspicion. He lived a pretty honest life, at least he did. He wouldn't be followed by those who would, though. His devout Hasidic background bore fruit in a life which could not offend the most meticulous scribe, that he lived very faithfully to the law of Moses up to the end of his life. Go ahead.
Was he of the tribe of Levi?
I'm actually not sure if he was of the tribe of Levi or not. I would assume he would be, because I would think the Hasidim would say absolutely not. If he was not a priest, I can't imagine that they would have stood for that. And the fact that he had a Hasidic background and that the Hasidim backed him up until he repudiated the Pharisees, I would imagine he was of the tribe of Levi, at least had some claim to it to begin with. And so his children, they're going to grow up in a palace that numbered themselves with the aristocrats, who were heavily influenced by the flowery Greek way of thought, by the philosophy that it made them sound sophisticated and educated. So the aristocracy is going to be heavily influenced by the Sadducees, by the Hellenizers, where your common man is probably going to be drawn more to your Pharisees. You're going to see that in your Bible. You're going to see that play out, that as you look at who the Pharisees are around, they're going to be around your common person, where your Sadducees are largely going to be limited to an aristocracy. So that's worth noting as well. Rand, would you mind handing some of that out for him? All right, so we can see that his children are actually going to look at the Pharisees with disdain. They're not going to want to join up. They're not going to want to sign up. They're going to label themselves as being Hellenizers. They're going to side with the Sadducees. All right, so let's look at Aristobulus then. The death of John Hyrcanus precipitated a dynastic struggle among his children. His eldest son, who preferred his Greek name Aristobulus to his Hebrew name Judah, emerged as the victor. As a typical tyrant, he cast three of his brothers into prison, where two are thought to have starved to death. Another brother was murdered in the palace. So already, this is the kind of character that would summarize the Hasmonean dynasty. These are not, just because they gained their independence, you may be saying, oh, yay, that's such a wonderful thing. But is it? Because look at the character of these leaders. Yeah, they may have political freedom, but that does not mean that these were good individuals. So Aristobulus believed to have murdered at least three of his brothers. He continued the policy of territorial expansion begun by Hyrcanus. In his short reign, he pushed the borders north to the territory around Mount Lebanon and took to himself the title king. Drink, disease, and the haunting fear of rebellion brought death only after a one-year reign. This man was as paranoid and fearful of rebellion and insurrection and being usurped that it killed him in 1 year. And nobody mourned this ruler passing. You can only imagine why. Alexander Janaeus. Let's look at Alexander Janaeus. So far we've looked at John Hyrcanus, Aristobulus, and Alexander Janaeus. We've looked at about three rulers so far. At the time of Aristobulus' death, he had only one brother alive in prison. His Hebrew name was Jonathan, and his Greek name was Alexander. History knows him as Alexander Janaeus. The policy of territorial expansion continued. They were doing their best, largely, and you're going to read about this in Lesson 6, they were doing their best to appear as a form of Messiah. They wanted to be the one who would carve out that kingdom of Solomon again and let it rain for 1,000 years. They wanted to be the guy to do that. They desperately wanted to be the guy to do that. And so you're going to see them continually pushing to expand their borders. Little did they know, there's a big red shadow on that map who's going to be crashing down on them like a wave by the end of the lesson. So despite the fact that they're carving out, and they're carving out for the sake of those who just walked in, we're looking at this little bitty green dot right here, that they're carving out this territory, and they're carving it and expanding it and getting it a little bit bigger. But there is a huge empire on the rise, and it is marching towards them. And it knows about them, because it declared the Maccabees friends of Rome, if you'll remember, that they knew, Rome knew where they were, and they were headed that way. And so Alexander Junius, again, continues to expand his territories as well. He was not always successful on the battlefield, but he did extend his frontiers along the Philistine coast, which would be identified as the Gaza Strip. You may have heard of that before. Well, that's this area just right here, just as you move kind of curving into Egypt. That's that Gaza Strip right there. And so it's the part right next to the Mediterranean. If you look at any Old Testament map and you look at where Gath is and several of the Philistine cities, those are all located within a region called Gaza. And so at this point, they had extended basically all the way to the frontiers of Egypt. They had just about made that entire area from Jordan all the way to Egypt. So this map is, again, it's only so accurate because it's designed to give you a cursory look at what you're examining. They just about expanded from that word Nabatea all the way over to Egypt by this point, which was remarkable for the fact that they were standing by themselves on their own 2 feet, fighting with their own arms, carving out their own territory. The size of the Jewish state was comparable to that of the glorious days of David and Solomon. Just like we said, they wanted to be that Messiah that would militarily come out and push out the Hellenizers and bring back in a golden age for Israel. They wanted to be that guy. But unfortunately, they were misguided in that. Again, you're going to see that in some of the apocalyptic literature that's going to take form during this time period. They would actually write about the Messiah as being a military conqueror and things like that. We'll see that next time, though. All right, open rebellion broke out between the Pharisees and the Hasmonean rulers at the memorable Feast of Tabernacles when Janaeus was officiating in the temple as king priest. Again, you saw the formulation of a king priest under the Maccabean rule, and then it's going to be perpetuated down into the Hasmonean dynasty, that the king and the priest, the high priest at one time, were separate. The king was in charge politically. The high priest was in charge of the temple, the sacrifices, the atonement. All of that fell in his jurisdiction, while running the civil government or the military fell under the king. However, now you have a king priest. You have a king and high priest who would run basically everything. He was the one in charge of it all. Remember, you can see the separation more clearly between Saul and Alexander Junius. King Saul was not able to offer sacrifices on the altar, and that's actually why the kingdom would be taken away from him. And so you think back at that. He was not a king priest. Now you have a king priest. Showing his contempt for the Pharisees, Janaeus poured out a water libation at his feet instead of on the altar, as prescribed by Pharisaic ritual. This led to an open civil war. Now, if you'll remember what happens in Acts chapter 23, Paul is standing in the Sanhedrin, and he says, he perceives that some are Sadducees, some are Pharisees, and he says, I am a Pharisee, the son of a Pharisee, and I am on trial for our beliefs. Understand, these two groups hated each other, which should tell you something about how powerful, how important the cause of Christ was, that it was able to unite the farthest apart enemies against it. that as long as they would try and, as long as it was there, they were going to unite against that. That just shows you, again, how, one, how powerful the gospel is, but two, how much they hated each other. It's not like, oh, well, we just differ on interpretation. No, they would be willing to, if Rome was not there, they would be willing to shed each other's blood. And this is not going to be the last time this happens. The Syrians came to the aid of the Pharisees and forced Jannaeus, which is actually kind of surprising. The Syrians were Hellenistic. So it's actually kind of surprising that they would side against the Sadducees. But they came to the aid of the Pharisees and forced Jannaeus into hiding in the Judean hills. It could be, that the Pharisees made a claim such as that as the Maccabees, and Syria learned their lesson the first time, that it's, they mopped the floor with us the first time. Let's back them. Let's put our money on that pony, because last time they kind of tore us up. So it could be that's why they supported them. Fearing that the Syrians would claim Judea as the fruit of their victory, and thinking that Alexander Jannaeus and his Sadducean sympathizers were sufficiently punished, thousands of the Pharisees deserted the Syrian army and went over to Jannaeus. As a sign, as a token of good favor, as a token of friendship, to bring him back into his power, to say, you learned your lesson, so we'll welcome you back. Don't do that again. Jannaeus gave a banquet for the Sadducean leaders to celebrate his victory. And he had 800 Pharisees crucified for their rebellion in front of his guests. And you want to know why the Pharisees and Sadducees in the time of Christ hated each other? This is why. This is why right here. It's things like this. You lose that if you don't study this time period, because you don't get to read about that in the text. You don't read about 800 crucifixions of the Pharisees. You miss this. And so I want to thank you for being here, because it helps give you some insight on that relationship between those two political parties, those two sects. Let's look at Alexandra now. Salome Alexandra had been married successively to Aristobulus and Alexander Jannaeus. The widow of two Hasmonean rulers, she succeeded to the throne as queen in her own right. So following Alexander Jannaeus, she made a very fitting ruler. Under Alexandra, the Pharisees had their opportunity to make a constructive contribution to Jewish life. Again, we talked about the Sadducees largely influenced who? The Sadducees. They're going to influence the aristocracy. They're going to appeal to the aristocracy's desire to sound really smart. They're going to appeal to that desire to sound sophisticated. And that's largely what Greek philosophy did. It made a very big appeal to the aristocracy. The Pharisees, however, are going to focus on the common man. They're going to become very popular with the common man. And so in many areas, particularly that of education, they were eminently successful. Well, who had need of education? The aristocracy or the common man? The common man. He's the one who needed that kind of support, so the Pharisee makes a play towards the commoner. The reign of Alexandra was peaceful in comparison with the years which preceded it. Her reign did not answer her country's problems, however. It didn't even heal its wounds, because the Pharisees and the Sadducees are largely still going to be at each other's throats. If the Pharisees were happy in their newfound recognition, the Sadducees were resentful of the fact that they had largely been debunked from their power. They have been deprived of that power. However, after Alexandra, the Sadducees found in Aristobulus II, the younger son of Jannaeus and Alexandra, the man that they would support as Alexandra's successor. He was a soldier, and he appealed to that party which dreamed of imperial expansion and worldly power. Again, the Sadducees would look to the prophecies of the Messiah to push this agenda right here. And they largely wanted to sculpt that mindset. And so, with the death of Alexandra, we're going to find the supporters of Aristobulus II are going to be pitted against the supporters of Hyrcanus II. And Hyrcanus II was congenial to the Pharisees. So again, you have a showdown between the Pharisees and the Sadducees in Aristobulus and Hyrcanus. So then let's look at these two men. All right, Hyrcanus the second. Well, let's look at him. He's letter E on your notes. At the death of Alexandra, her older son, Hyrcanus, who had been serving as high priest, succeeded to the throne as Hyrcanus the second. Immediately, Aristobulus the second, as he would be known, led an army of Sadducees against Jerusalem. Well, Hyrcanus was not a very assertive individual. And when he saw an army marching after him, he said, "You know what? I didn't want this throne anyway. You can have it. I'll give it over to you. I didn't have any interest in it anyway." So Hyrcanus and the Pharisees, they did not have the enthusiasm for it, nor did they have the capability. These were not the Maccabees. They were not warriors. And so they surrender. They say, "That's fine. You can have it. We won't even put up a fight." Declaring he never really desired the throne, Hyrcanus surrendered all his honors to Aristobulus, who became king and high priest. Again, there's your king priest that before wasn't there, under the name Aristobulus II. So let's look at him. By right of conquest, the Judean throne was safely in the hands of Aristobulus II and backed by the Sadducees. Hyrcanus and Aristobulus vowed eternal friendship, that they were going to work together here. Aristobulus' eldest son, Alexander, married Hyrcanus' only daughter, Alexandra. Peace between the brothers was short-lived because Hyrcanus found it advisable or necessary to flee to Aretas, king of the Nabataean Arabs. Now, if you open your Bible and you look in Matthew 2, verse 1, you're going to read about a man. What man do you think that will be? I'll give you a hint. He took all of the infants of a certain age or younger and killed them. You're going to read about Herod the Great. Where does he come from? Where did the Herods even begin with? It begins with Antipater, or Antipater. I've heard it pronounced both ways. I'll probably use Antipater. Antipater, an Idumean or Edomite by birth, saw in the position of Hyrcanus an opportunity to fulfill his own dream of being a political power in Judea. That Antipater was, although he was an Edomite, he wanted to rule in this area because he knew that it was an important location between Egypt and the Syrians, between Egypt and the Seleucids. He knew it was a notable location. There was political gain to be had there. And so he starts to figure out a way in which he can work into that political scene. He found that in Hyrcanus. Antipater suggested that the Nabataean Arabs come to Jerusalem, drive out the usurper, that is, Aristobulus II. They drive out Aristobulus II, they can set up a puppet ruler in Hyrcanus II. And so that's not what he said. He said something like, "He's a usurper, put the rightful heir in his place. Be the good guy." That's how they would have said it. Hyrcanus agrees, of course. Remember, this is not a very assertive individual. He was one who was willing to please who he was around. So, Antipater and the Nabataean Arabs want to go to Jerusalem. So he says, "Okay, you can put me back in power. That's fine." Aretas and his Nabataean Arabs invaded Palestine and besieged Jerusalem. Aristobulus was caught by surprise. He shut himself up in Jerusalem, and both sides prepare then for a long siege. And this is where we're going to leave them for now. We'll pick them up again before the end of the lesson, but we need to stop and talk about the Romans. As you can see, they had already expanded into the Iberian Peninsula, into northern Africa. They're expanding up into Central Europe. They're expanding into Eastern Europe and into the Balkans. They had actually already conquered the Balkans by this point. They are going to be expanding into Pergamum and then even further into Asia Minor. They are expanding at a very, very rapid route or very rapid rate. And so we need to talk then about that little red dot. If you will remember, this is where they started. about 3 decades before Samaria fell to the Assyrians. Whoa, what? Before Samaria fell to the Assyrians. Remember the very first slide that we had in this class? I showed you Assyria and Babylon, and then Babylon taking over Assyria, and then Persia taking over Babylon. Assyria, when they took Samaria, around that time, it's the legend states that Romulus and Remus founded the city of Rome. So if that roughly puts in your mind when Rome actually got started, that's when it got started. It was a very small village by that, or at that point.
You might tell them a little bit about Romulus and Remus. It's really interesting.
Okay, so Romulus and Remus were believed to be brothers who were orphans. And they were found by a she-wolf and raised by a she-wolf. So if you ever hear the phrase, raised by wolves, that's kind of where it comes from. Is that they were, legend has it, they were raised by wolves. So they then wanted to, or they started this village, and there was a disagreement between the two, and Romulus killed Remus, which is why it's known as Rome instead of Reem. But that's kind of the idea behind the legend. There is also what Virgil wrote, saying that Aeneas, in the Aeneid, actually a survivor of the Trojan War, would make a journey across and actually set up the city of Rome. Probably the first, and probably only part of the first. That would be my guess, because, not to get into too much detail, but I think Virgil just ripped off the Iliad. That's my own thoughts. If you disagree, that's fine. But that's largely where the city of Rome came from. It would quickly grow, but it was under the control, as you can see, by the Etruscans. And the Etruscans were a pretty oppressive group, and in 509 BC, they eventually revolted and killed Tarquin, the king. And they took him to a cliff and threw him over a cliff. And then they all stood there saying, what on earth did we just do? We just not only revolted, but committed treason. So they had to, in a day, figure out what they were going to do. So they came up with the res publica, or the public thing. Because they did not want a king. They just threw their king off a cliff. They did not want a king. So they came up with the res publica, or the public thing, the republic. And from that point, they were going to grow and expand. And because of that republic, they would actually expand very quickly and very well, because they would not rule as a tyrant over their neighbors. They actually treated them as client kingdoms, that as long as they paid tribute and men, they could govern themselves, practice their own religion, whatever they wanted to do, as long as they paid tribute and paid men. They had to give soldiers for their legions. They had to pay taxes. Other than that, they were free. And because of that, they would expand very rapidly. This would, of course, make them very greedy, though, that because they were expanding so rapidly, they would be looking for fights to pick. And that's what happens with Carthage. Carthage, at this point, was the world power in the Mediterranean. They had one of the most vast fleets the Mediterranean has ever seen. They would be very wealthy. They had traded all the way up with the Norse. That's not even on my map. That's all the way up in Norway. They would be trading with them. They would be trading with the Celts over in Ireland. They would be trading with individuals in Britain. They would be trading with people along the northern Germanic coast in France. That's how far Carthage was expanding. So if it's blue, it's Carthage. So that's about how far they were expanding. Well, Rome would look at that wealth and they would say, let's go to war with them. And so they would pick a fight with them and start something known as the Punic Wars. And the first Punic War was largely over the island of Sicily. The second one, of course, is going to be much closer to home for the Carthaginians. And so they're going to go to war with Carthage, and that was in 146 BC. By 145, Carthage was destroyed. It was annihilated and wiped out by Scipio Africanus. He put an end to a power which had threatened Rome itself. Hannibal, although he's not obviously not on the map, Hannibal invaded Italy through the Alps. If you'll remember, Hannibal was one of the world's greatest generals by going up through Iberia, up around through the Alps, and invaded Italy. He almost took Rome from right out from under the Romans' nose, because all of their soldiers were south, and he was just about unopposed. It was really a race of time that Rome got to Carthage before he got largely to the heart, the centers of Rome. So it was a tough fight, but Rome came out on top. This would establish Rome as the primary world power in the Western world, of the known world at this point. Which then, if you've conquered just about anything of, in their eye, political value to the West, which direction do you go? You go east. So, that's what they do. They head east. They extend over Macedonia, Corinth, all of Achaia. In 135 BC, so let's jump ahead to 135. By the way, you're seeing Parthia grow over there. In 135, Attalus, king of Pergamum, bequeathed his territory to the Romans. You may see this Pergamon right here. It's actually a city-state right on the coast of Asia Minor. He's going to, at that point, 135, Rome had already been, they'd already reached Asia Minor. That's how rapidly they were expanding. And so the Roman province of Asia was then formed. If you're following along in your notes, we are already looking at Pompey entering Palestine. This is going to be your fourth page. All right, Pompey was a very, very talented general that Rome had, but he was also a very ruthless individual. This, and we'll talk about it later, yeah, because it's on our notes. Learning about the quarrel between the brothers, Pompey, who was, and remember the brothers, Aristobulus II and Hyrcanus II? Okay, Pompey hears about that and says, let's go there. If they're fighting each other, it's only rife territory, because that's less soldiers we had to fight. The reason Macedonia and Greece fell so quickly to Rome is because you'll remember just before that time period, Alexander had come through and taken the Macedonians and moved them east. And then after him, Lysimachus and Cassander had the Macedonians and Thracians and moved them east. You're losing two generations of warriors. And then Rome comes knocking on your door. You have no one left to fight them. You have what's left against the might of Rome. And that's not enough. And so that's why they were able to expand so quickly. This area from here eastward had been ravaged by war. During the time of the Diadochi, that was a bloody time. We covered the relationship between Egypt and the Seleucids, but we did not cover between Cassander and between Lysimachus and between Antigonus. We didn't talk about all of that. But there was a lot of bloody fighting going on, which depopulated Macedonia. It depopulated Greece. So when Rome came in, there was really no one left to stop them. So they were largely uncontested in that. So Pompey, who was in the east, in the interest of building up the Roman Empire, he took an immediate interest in the Jewish politics. He knew that that would be easy to gain access to Egypt by taking that territory. So he said, let's go there. Under the guise of a willingness to arbitrate the difficulties, Rome became the force which was to determine the future of Palestine. Pompey personally intervened to get a route of the quarrel between Aristobulus and Hyrcanus. He observed evidences of the plan of Aristobulus to revolt against Rome. Yeah, right. Probably planted there by Romans. So they had justification to go in there and wipe them out. A Roman army besieged Jerusalem, and Hyrcanus supported Pompey against his brother. Jerusalem was besieged for 3 months, and finally the fortifications were breached. 12,000 Jews are said to have been slaughtered in the battle which followed. Pompey, with his officers, entered the Holy of Holies in the temple. He was assassinated years later, by Jews in Egypt for this sacrilege. That the Jews were so shocked and offended by this, that they said, that man is marked for death. And they would find him later. I believe it was about 14 years later that Pompey would be assassinated. But they waited a long time to eat that out. And so they did. He got off of a ship, and on the docks, they stabbed him. They took him out.
You might state that when Pompey took over Israel, it was about 63, 64
mm-hmm.
B.C.
Well, yeah, we're coming up on that date. But yes, he comes into this area around 63, 64 B.C. That's about whenever this was taking place, whenever he's pushing into this. So I want to jump you ahead to 100, and you're going to see, of course, Rome just expands further and further and further. By the way, the Nabataean Arabs had this territory right here. You can see Judea growing a little bit in there, but again, if we jump ahead another 10 years, Rome captures that area of Cyrene. This is where Cyrene is. This is what's called Libya around Cyrene. That's that area right there in Acts chapter 2. You can notice again the Parthians are continuing to expand. Rome is pushing deeper and deeper into the east. By the year 70 B.C., the Iberian Peninsula, except for a small group of Celts way up in the north of the Iberian Peninsula, held almost all of the Mediterranean at this point, is held by Rome. Egypt is being flanked on both sides by Rome, one by Cyrene, the other, of course, by the Judean-Palestinian area. Judea, by this point, in the year 70 B.C., you can see Rome was on their doorstep. They were the ones mediating and moderating everything for them. And that's, of course, by the time you hit 41 B.C., they're completely engulfed. They've been completely taken over by Rome. And so then let's continue looking at Antipater, who came into power whenever all of this happened. How did that take place? During the years of strife between Aristobulus II and Hyrcanus II, the Idumean governor Antipater, or Antipas, took an interest in the politics of Judea. Antipater was bitterly opposed to Aristobulus, partly through fear and partly because of his friendship with Hyrcanus. Well, yeah, he's your puppet. If you can get him in office and you can direct him how you want him, it does not matter who is sitting on the throne. It's the idea of a power behind the throne. So, of course, he didn't want Aristobulus, who was much more willful than Hyrcanus, in place. The Jews resented the presence of Antipater almost as much as they resented the fact that they were subject to Rome, because Antipater was Idumean. He was an Edomite, and they knew he was an Edomite, and they did not want an Edomite ruling over them. Ironically, they're going to look to the Herods, who were his children. They were Idumean. But it was the fact that this man had come from over here to here. He did not start here to begin with. That would be different for the Herods, because they would actually begin there. Antipater, the father of the Herods, was not there with them. So they resented him all his life. Antipater was an Idumean, or an Edomite according to the Old Testament nomenclature. The Edomites had been the hereditary enemies of the Jews, and under John Hyrcanus, the Idumeans had been forcibly incorporated into the Jewish nation, and they could not stand that. They hated that. All right, so then we get to Herod the Great. Go ahead.
Not only were they forced into the Jewish nation, they were forced to accept Judaism and learned about the Old Testament.
Oh, well, yes. In order to be good rulers, the Idumeans learned everything they could and became experts at it. And they would have been able to have some of the best teachers available to them. And so the Idumeans were glad to be there. The Jews hated the fact that that was forced upon them. And they hated the fact that the Romans were largely behind that. That they were the ones, the reason that this could have happened in the first place. So let's look at Herod the Great then. In the crisis which followed the murder of Julius Caesar, Antipater and his sons showed their loyalty to the new regime of Cassius by zealously collecting tribute. Herod was given the title Procurator of Judea, with the promise that he would one day be named king, but when Mark Antony defeated Brutus and Cassius at Philippi, Asia fell into the hands of the new Roman regime. Herod, ever an opportunist, quickly changed sides. He was like, oh, did I say Cassius? I meant Mark Antony, of course. So he quickly changes sides there. He doesn't take a moment's breath to switch his loyalty. Go ahead.
In the lineage of the Roman rulers, Cassius is not mentioned. So was he a general that was a friend of Brutus? Is that where he fits in?
He was not a ruler because up to this point, Julius Caesar was just he's the one who carved out this right here. He was the Roman general over the Gallic conquest. And so he was going north. He was going north, and he was battling individuals. Most notably, he took out the Gallic ruler Vercingetorix. He took him out, who was noted for standing obstinately against Rome. And so, using that kind of popularity, he then carries that popularity with him into thinking, you know what? I have a legion behind me who will back me with their lives. I'm going to cross the Rubicon. I'm going to march into Rome, which was against the laws of the Senate, against the laws of the Republic. So he does. He marches on Rome and captures it by force. And the people loved it. But not everybody did, because they said, that's where tyranny begins. And so Cassius was one of those individuals who said, no, we need to take him out. We need to remove him, because this is where tyranny begins. So they assassinate him. They were largely behind that plot. Brutus as well, because although he was Julius Caesar's friend, he also believed the same thing. He believed that the Republic was the best way to go there. This isn't my own political beliefs, by the way. This is just why they did what they did. So I'm just throwing that out there. I don't really care what Julius Caesar thought or Brutus or Cassius said. Mark Antony defeated Brutus and Cassius, so he defeats Herod the Great was supporting. So Herod the Great then says, well, I'll support Mark Antony. So he is willing to support whoever's winning, basically. All right, the Parthians, who occupied a part of the eastern territory of the once mighty Persian Empire, which they pretty much held the entire Persian holdings at this point, with the exception of Asia Minor and Judea. They had not been subdued by Rome. They actually, in 41 BC, they attacked and took Jerusalem and made Antigonus, the son of Aristobulus II, king and high priest. There you see it again. Herod, the son of Antipater, had inherited the throne of Judea at the death of Hyrcanus and was forced to flee to Rome. There he won the favor of Antony, who bestowed upon him the title King of the Jews. So it was Mark Antony then, who then kind of gives him that title to begin with. Whenever the Parthians would leave Jerusalem, it's going to be Herod the Great coming back there with that title, with that backing of Mark Antony, that is, he's going to then carry it over into his ruling the Jews. So you're going to see that. Again, the Parthians had a fighting style that was a very good counter to the Roman fighting style. They had the capability of keeping them at a distance because their military was largely made up of cavalry archers, that they would ride on horseback and shoot arrows at their opponents. Incredibly hard for them to fight against because largely the Romans didn't fight that way. They fought in blocks or regiments of legionaries, not on horseback. They did have cavalry, but not to the point that the Parthians did. They would never be able to push any deeper into Parthia. And so you can kind of see their eastern borders then of Parthia and Arabia. All right, let's go ahead and finish up. We're a little bit over time. Of course, we covered a lot of material today, too. To make friends with the Hasmoneans, Herod married two of them, Mariamne, the granddaughter of John Hyrcanus II, and Miriam, the granddaughter of Aristobulus II. So he marries a granddaughter from the two who could have claimed succession. So he pretty solidly cements his own right to rule by marrying the granddaughters of the rulers. Though they had children, they never got along well, probably because Antipater had killed Aristobulus. Yeah, that would probably do it. If your dad killed my dad, I don't think we're going to get along. Although Herod's reign was one of trouble, there were many accomplishments for which he should be given credit, which is why he is given the title the Great. I'll tell you, it's not because he was a good person. It's only because of the great, and I tell you, fantastic works of art constructive works that he was able to produce. You can even go see a few of them that are still standing today. Not the temple, however. That was prophesied to be completely torn down to its foundations. Foremost among these was his building program. Whole cities were built or rebuilt by him. Samaria, Caesarea, which he named after Caesar. That was his construction. That was his project. Antipatris, named after his father Antipater. Phasaelus and Anthedon. Anthedon, named after his friend Mark Antony. Fortresses were also built. Herodion, not to be proud or anything. Alexandrian, Hyrcania, after the Hyrcanian lineage. Macarius and Masada. You may know of Masada because Masada, of course, would be the last location that the Zealots or the Sicarii in particular would stand against Rome in AD 70 through 72. It would be Masada where they would finally quash all rebellion in Palestine. His greatest accomplishment, and Masada is still there, by the way. You can check it out online. Feel free to look at it because you can still see the siege ramp that the Romans built up to the wall, because it's up on a plateau. Yeah, that'd be the best way to describe it. It's up on a plateau. His greatest accomplishment was the construction of the temple in Jerusalem, which was still being constructed in the time of Jesus, and you can see that in John 2, verse 20. But the Jews also distrusted Herod when they thought about the temple. If King David could not build the first temple because his hands were too bloody, then how clean could the hands of Herod be? He had already, at this point, killed a lot of people. And they're sitting here saying, if David, our father David, couldn't build the temple, who is this guy to build the temple? Well, it is a nice temple. But him? And so they were kind of torn between that. And then secondly, Herod's friendship with Rome was a big turnoff to the people of Judea. When Herod set a golden eagle, the symbol of imperial Rome, on the temple gate, the Pharisees called it proof that Herod served not God, but Augustus, and they were correct. He did serve Augustus, Caesar. They tore it down at the cost of their own lives. When you read about the Pharisees, I genuinely believe that a lot of preachers give them a bad rap. They were willing to make these kinds of stands right here that said, no, that is not okay. That is wrong. yes, they took it too far, and the rebukes they got from Jesus were deserved. But many of the Pharisees became obedient to the faith, and that shouldn't surprise you because they were the ones who had originally come from the Hasidim, the pious ones, the faithful ones. So they had good roots, and they had good intentions. It's that by the time they got to Christ, as we'll look at in Lesson 6, they had already deviated a little too much from the law, and that was their downfall. Not their zeal, because right here shows that zeal for God. At the cost of their own lives, they were not willing to have any graven images, any objects like that, within the walls of Jerusalem. Despite all he did, Herod remained an unpopular king. His paranoia and personal cruelties outweighed his piety. His Idumean blood made him suspect anyway, and as he grew older, he grew more mentally unstable. Domestic troubles plagued him. Even the crown prince, Antipater III, hated him. He murdered Mariamnes, the favorite of his 10 wives. Her grandfather, John Hyrcanus II, her brother Aristobulus, and several of his own children. The massacre of the infants in Bethlehem, when he heard about the birth of Jesus, was only the last of many of his atrocities that he committed. That's recorded, of course, for you in Matthew 2, verse 16. When Augustus learned of these acts, he noted that Herod did not eat pork in observance of the Jewish law. He remarked, "It's better to be Herod's hog than his son," which is one humorous way of putting such an atrocious man in a proper frame of light, that it would be better to be a hog around Herod than to be his son. He died on April 1st, 4 B.C. Cancer of the intestines and dropsy were suggested as its causes. He left behind a reputation of infamy. He allowed his passions to master him, and he must go down in history as one of the world's greatest failures. That he was jealous even of the infant Jesus shows the extent of which desire for worldly sovereignty may lead a man astray.
With all that history that you just talked about, how mentally unstable and messed up Herod was, in verse 3 of chapter 2, it's interesting where it says, King Herod, when he had heard that, you know, about Jesus, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him.
Yeah.
They were all troubled because they knew what kind of a character Herod was.
Yeah.
And the problems that they were worried about happening.
Certainly, and you can only imagine why, because they're probably thinking, wow, if he's willing to kill his favorite wife, and then to turn around and kill his own sons and several other people, it's like, nobody tell him anything. Just don't say anything to him. And so whenever he finds out, oh, by the way, the king is born in Bethlehem, it's like, now you've done it. Thanks a lot.
You call yourself wise guy?
Really. Next lesson, we're going to look at the particular sects, the different groups that had formed in Judea at this time. We've seen the beginning and where they were first mentioned of the Pharisees and Sadducees, and you can already see the instrumental part they had in the development of this historical period. But we're also going to look at a few more groups as well, such as the Essenes, the Zadokites, the Zealots. How did I forget about the Zealots? We're going to look at those different groups as well, and we're going to look more into their beliefs, their practices, and kind of what they stood for and what part they had to play. Go ahead.
Was it a Zealot that killed Pompey? Because, I mean, you said he got stabbed with a knife.
I imagine so. It would probably either be a Zealot. I don't know if the Sicarii existed at this time, but that was a far side wing of the zealotry.
That's the first thing I thought of when you said that. Ooh, Zealot got him.
Yeah, well, that's probably the case. If they did exist, and I'm sure they were at least in formulation at this time, just like the Hellenists were the formulation of the Sadducees and the Hasidim were the formulation of the Pharisees, I imagine with the Seleucids, the Parthians, the Egyptians, and the Nabataeans, someone in there was saying, you know, I don't like all these Gentiles around ruling. We need to rule ourselves. And so it probably was at least someone who would have identified with the Zealots had he been in the time of the Zealots. That's all I had for today, and I apologize for going a little bit over time. But we've ended the others a little early, so it's okay to go 10 minutes over. There are no more handouts, but I can always print up more. So if you did not get one, I can easily get you one. Lesson 6, I think we have one more lesson 6. So I appreciate everyone's attention. It's been a good class.